There's a basic question hanging over American politics right now. What if liberalism simply can't deliver? To many on the right, liberalism's failures are obvious, which lays the groundwork for something new to take its place. Ideas that used to be fringe, post-liberalism, nationalism, even a type of fascism, now roam the halls of power. Premises that used to feel non-negotiable, like free trade, individual liberty, even the idea that economic growth is central, are discarded without a second glance. Ross Douthat is a New York Times opinion columnist and host of the podcast Interesting Times, which has become a must-listen for anyone who wants to understand what's going on in the modern evolution of the right. He's also the best person I could think of to unpack what's going on in the Republican Party and whether liberalism really has failed. In this conversation, we talk about the collapse of fusionism, the rise of nationalism, and what happens when political power flows through influencers and media ecosystems more than parties. Then we argue about our deeper question, whether economic growth and abundance can rescue liberalism, or whether the crisis is ultimately cultural and spiritual in ways that growth alone can't fix. My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the founder and editor of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism for the 21st century. On this podcast, we bring together everyone from socialists to conservatives in conversation over the most important issues of the day. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com. Ross Douthat, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So your role at the New York Times, and I think of your role broadly in my own intellectual development, has been translating conservatives to liberals who don't want to hear it is largely how I think about
it. It's a wonderful burden to carry. That description. Yes.
Yeah. I've appreciated it more in the last couple of years than I think I did before, in part because I think every single liberal has been forced to care more about what conservatives think as they've been more ascendant publicly. But hopefully when they're on the outs again, I'll still be really locked in. But I want to start there because the right is in such a state of transition, I think even more so than the left is right now, in ways that I think has made the word conservative kind of illegible to people. I struggle when I'm writing, and I know editors at various publications struggle, like, what are we saying when we say someone's a conservative? What are we even talking about? We're calling them right wing. Like, what do these terms even mean in this moment? You know, is Marco Rubio a conservative? Is Tom Tillis a conservative? Is Trump a conservative? You recently wrote a piece for The Times titled Trump's Second Term Has Ended the Conservative Era. Can you walk us through your argument there? And in doing so, could you also broadly describe the factions on the right at this moment that you see as vying for power?
So you have 2.5 hours for us to walk through the factions.
Exactly.
Because
like,
we have to be able to get into, yeah. You know, we have to get into, like, you know, Falangist faction 777, you know, subgroup Q on X. The piece was basically arguing that you can think of the conservative movement, meaning, you know, whatever it was that emerged in the 1950s, coalesced around National Review and William F. Buckley, and then sort of was connected to Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan, all the institutions that we think of as sort of conservative, as having reached kind of an end of its coherence as a sort of, you know, politics shaping force somewhere in the Trump era. Meaning a combination of things, meaning in part that it had sort of succeeded in certain of its goals. This had been true long before Trump came along, but one of the notable things about the Trump era was that there were a bunch of sort of old conservative movement goals, like, you know, ending affirmative action or overturning Roe v. Wade, that had seemingly slipped out of reach of the right 15 or 20 years ago, that ended up being fulfilled by Trump. So there's sort of an interesting fulfillment of movement goals joined to a kind of profound sidelining of the sort of mood and temperament and perspective on America that we associate with, say, a figure like Ronald Reagan, joined also to a kind of transition to a new institutional alignment in conservatism. I think And I see I just used the term conservatism, but I think it's better to talk about the right right now than conservatism, mm-hmm. because there's clearly various competing forms of right-wing politics in America, of which a kind of sort of conservation-oriented politics, it's one of them, but it's by no means the dominant force. And so, but just on the institutions question, you know, even in the first Trump era, it was meaningful to look around and say, well, you know, Trump has changed a lot, but, you know, the Heritage Foundation, the sort of traditional conservative enterprise, is still delivering him domestic policy goals. You know, Fox News is sort of the central media node on the right, with various magazines and publications revolving around it. By the time we reach the early 2020s and certainly 2024, 2025, I feel like you've fully transitioned to a world where those institutions have been weakened or transformed or convulsed, like Heritage, by internal fights, or have been sort of marginalized, like you would have thought of, you know, the American Enterprise Institute, where I should say I'm a visiting fellow. That would have been a kind of a central node of whatever conservatism was in the George W. Bush era. Now it's sort of completely outside the Trumpist zone, the zone of power. And in place of that, you have what? A landscape of influencers, podcasters, sort of new media figures, some of whom are on Fox, but they're not like defined by any of those old institutions. When there was this kind of intense intra-right civil war after the death of Charlie Kirk, it was all, you know, people with different podcasting platforms, different social media platforms going into battle with one another in ways that just had no relationship to the network of institutions that defined the right even 10 years ago. So that's sort of a short way of thinking about why it makes sense to say there was this thing called the conservative movement. It had a set of goals. It was embodied in certain forms, and it's reached a point where enough of its goals have been achieved, enough have been rejected, and there's been enough institutional turnover to say that moment in the history of right-wing politics has ended, and is, or at least we're transitioning to something else. And it's like, you know, if you can think about this historically in terms of sort of the left and the center left, right? Like, you have an era that we, in American history, that we call the era of progressivism or the progressive movement. And that era, you know, you can define it with various timestamps, but it's basically an early 20th century phenomenon. And by the time you get to certainly the Eisenhower era or the Great Society, there's still something that is connected to the earlier progressive era, but you wouldn't use that terminology because there's been just sort of a transformation in the life of liberalism. So we're having a transformation in the life of right-wing politics, and something different exists or is taking shape. I'm not sure exactly what shape it will ultimately take. In the essay, I use the term nationalism because I think that is the most coherent descriptor for the kind of right-wing politics we have right now. But, you know, there's just different zones. There's zones of traditionalism. There's zones of reactionary futurism, right? Mm-hmm. You might call it whatever you get from sort of a Silicon Valley right-wing politics. You have, you know, sort of libertarian-ish elements and sort of, you know, quasi-fascist elements, I think it's, mm-hmm. you know, I think it's fair to say. But then you also just have these really concrete battles playing out, like the one, you know, after Charlie Kirk, you know, it's like, all right, we're going to have a battle over the position of Israel and Zionism in right-wing politics. And that battle seems to me completely unsettled. And the last point I made in the essay, or one of the last points, was just that Trump himself, he's ended an era. He's ushered in sort of a new era, but he himself is just not the kind of figure who sort of decides questions, right, mm-hmm. once and for all. Like, it's not like Donald Trump is going to determine permanently what nationalism means. Mm-hmm. He changes his mind about what Trumpism means from, you know, from week to week and social media post to social media post. So there's this is
genius too. Like, his genius of Trump is that he has very few actual firm policy or ideological commitments, which allows him to be such a successful political animal.
Well, it's his genius relative to the kind of sclerosis that afflicted parts of the right before he came along, certainly, mm-hmm. where if you watched him in the 2016 campaign, you know, he would get in fights with Ted Cruz, where Cruz would be sort of flabbergasted that Trump was deviating from the tenets of true conservatism, capital mm-hmm. T, capital C, right? But all that that meant was that there was this version of true conservatism that had become too ossified and hyper-ideological to actually deal with reality, right? So in that mm-hmm. sense, yeah, Trump is liberated from those kind of strictures, but he's also just sort of too liberated in a sense, I think, when you think of, you know, where Franklin Roosevelt left liberalism or where Reagan mm-hmm. left conservatism, both of them were experimental, unpredictable figures who had a lot of different incarnations. The New Deal had a lot of different forms. Reagan himself was, you know, the sort of, you know, social moderate in the 60s who became more socially conservative, who was the Cold War hawk, who made deals with Gorbachev. There was plenty of mm-hmm. flexibility there. But still, at the end, you could say, okay, there is something called Reaganism that his successors would try to imitate. I think with Trump, it's less clear that that's true. Like, what does Trumpian foreign policy mean? It can mean anything from giving speeches saying, we don't do nation building anymore, and, you know, America is focused on our core interests now, to, you know, sending an armada, right? What are we doing right now? Sending an armada to threaten the Iranian dictatorship while we promise to ramp up military spending. It's just, it's very protean, and I think it will leave his successors with just a lot of different options for claiming to be the heir of Trump. Like, mm-hmm. Marco Rubio could claim to be the heir of Trump, and so could Tucker Carlson, and would they agree on very much? I'm not sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing that I've been thinking about in this era is that, you know, fusionism, which you sort of described for us already, or the coming together of the traditional social conservative and religious right with the economic right libertarians and business interests, that kind of defined the Republican Party coalition for the latter half of the 20th century until very recently. You know, that is in many ways aligning a ton of like smaller differences that existed throughout that time period. We're using kind of these broad, capacious categories to describe something that was real, but it was also, you know, there were a bunch of people who probably were very anti-immigration, who had very similar Trumpian views, who didn't like the free market strictures and were not happy in this coalition, but just went along. And what I've been thinking about is in this modern era of as you mentioned, all these podcasters, all of these different democratization of media and politics, whether it's even possible to have a new fusionism at all. Like, can you align all of these very, you know, small but meaningful to many people differences in ideology to create a new right or even a new left? Will that be allowed when there's really no one who can be a gatekeeper?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. And I think it connects to a bigger question about our politics right now, which is the inability of presidents to essentially maintain even slight majority coalitions for more than like a few months after they take office, right? Where, you know, it used to be that you had a lot more swing voters and it was normal to win presidential elections with 54-55% of the vote. Okay, now you win them with 50% or 51%. But then beyond that, nobody seems to have a clear theory of how you hold swing voters after you win, right? And you could argue that that's connected to the phenomenon that you describe, that like there is so much democratization, so much sort of incentives for conflict in media and political organizing and all of these things, right, that holding together even a narrow 51% coalition is like trying to, you know, throw a blanket over a ton of kittens or something. Where I have some kittens in this room behind me. That's why the metaphor. I didn't just pluck that metaphor out of the ether.
Out of nowhere, yeah.
Out of nowhere. But where they're, you know, somebody's always trying to kin out, and it's all you can do to hold your 40%, right? This is sort of where Trump has ended up. Trump's approach is you give up the middle, but you, you know, whatever you do, you make sure that you don't crack your 40% base. But maybe that's all. Maybe that's all that you can achieve. I guess I'm a little skeptical of that because I think some of it is a self-fulfilling prophecy, and you have people in the political class on both sides, different forms on right and the left, who are telling themselves this narrative. People really like this narrative because it flatters the biases of people who get way too into politics, right? It's like, oh, I have my ideological commitments and my enemies have their ideological commitments, and it's all coherent and perfect, and we're locked in this battle to the death, and we don't need to worry about, you know, what this dwindling pool of swing voters thinks. Or you've seen this from people on the right in, you know, some of the debates about immigration policy in Minneapolis, this idea that, like, well, if you just show strength, swing voters will follow. Like, swing voters, all right, they get a little uncomfortable with ICE showing up in masks and asking people for ID. But ultimately, once Donald Trump crushes the protesters, then, you know, the average American will get on board. That kind of narrative. The narratives are a little different on the left, but they're similarly oriented towards this kind of idea of politics as a binary with no one in between. But that's not true. The number of swing voters has shrunk, but it's still substantial. That's why we have these wild shifts where Donald Trump can win a majority of the popular vote. And I, you know, if I'm being an optimist, I would say American politics is waiting for a politician who is a little more gifted or a little more sort of devoted to the idea of maintaining a big tent. And when that person comes along, we'll look back and say, oh, you know, well, Biden was too old to do it and Trump was too undisciplined to do it. And Obama did it for a while, but sort of threw it away in his second term. But it was possible. It was always possible, and you just needed to do it. One other thing, though, about the right, though, that I would say on the fusionism question, I do think part of the challenge for the right is that part of what bound the right together for so long was just this sense that, like, okay, there were these different factions, but there was this sort of shared understanding of America that they were defending, of America as this country, you know, a sort of a commercial republic, you know, with you know, a weaker than average central government, a lot of religious and communitarian sentiment that sort of was, you know, you could sort of rely on even if elites were sort of secular. And that, I think a big reason that the right has changed is that that sort of substrate seems much weaker or even non-existent to people on the right. Right. Like you're trying, you hear this a lot from younger conservatives. Like, what did the conservative movement really conserve if the government never stopped growing, / you know, religion and piety and community involvement have all been in steep decline? And then maybe we're still a free market economy, but, you know, we're sort of regulated to death, and the industries that sort of, you know, once supported the right aren't as powerful anymore. I don't know. You can tell different stories there. But I do think the right is in a moment where fusionism depended on the idea that there was something, there was a clear and coherent vision of what Americanism was. The conservative movement was out to defend and preserve it. It could be Burkean because there was something to be Burkean about. And I think one thing that, like, the Trump era right is just correct about, doesn't know what to do about it, but it's correct, is that a right-wing politics now would have to do more rebuilding and less sort of custodial work, because we just have, you know, deinstitutionalized our own society in this pretty profound way.
No, I think you're definitely right that the incentive to view politics as no longer, the idea that you can no longer have a majoritarian government flatters ideologues, because it means, like, okay, maybe my views are very, you know, only held by 30% of the country, but that's just the way things are now. So it's okay for that to be how I do politics. And then I can push my elected officials to take pretty unpopular positions because 30% is the best you're going to get. But I want to step back from prognosticating a bit and talking and analyzing a bit about the right, and talk more about your actual vision of the good and what that is. You've been on your right, I think, your whole life. And I wonder now, as you're looking at all of these different factions, what is your ideal trajectory for where this all goes? Where would you want to see the Republican coalition go? Like, which factions do you find to be better serving the values that you hold?
Well, this will sound like wishful thinking. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, I've been writing about conservatism for a long time. And I think one thing that's pretty clear to me is that my personal preferences are unlikely to be fully expressed.
We're so minoritarians. It's
so
over.
Sometimes, yeah. Well, I mean, I had, you know, in that essay that you mentioned, I had a paragraph where I said, well, here's my, you know, my preferred trajectory. And I got a lot of sort of snide responses saying, oh, well, this mm-hmm. is totally out of touch. And I just want to concede. I don't think I am in touch with like where the right is definitely going. You put in that paragraph because you're trying, you know, you're trying to be helpful and useful, mm-hmm. right? You want to say, you don't want to just do analysis. You want to have some kind of prescriptive element. But again, this would not be a prediction about where the right is going. I think that the ideal version of the right, starting from where you are right now, would be one that recovered a greater emphasis on Christianity and religion in its social vision, mm-hmm. Which would, from the point of view of the left, on the one hand, dial down some of the things that the left is most upset about right now, like not immigration enforcement per se, but the style in which, mm-hmm. the manner in which immigration enforcement is carried out, the general sort of like fuck you atmosphere that pervades the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. There's sort of a spirit of unchristian anger and contempt, I think, that is very manifest on the right. And I think a more Christian, more religious form of conservative politics would move away from that. At the same time, I think it would also move in a sort of, in certain ways, a more moralistic direction that at least some people on the left would not like. I think it would be good if the right was more concerned with what you might call sort of the problem of vice in our society right now, mm-hmm. Meaning everything from marijuana to gambling to pornography. Like, I think we need actually a little more Puritanism in America, mm-hmm. right now. That aspect of the religious right has really been lost. Like, there was a time when the right was against gambling, right? Like, that was like a part of what, especially a kind of Protestant religious politics meant in America, right? Like, I think it would be good if some of that came back. In foreign policy, I am, you know, determined to believe that it's possible to split the difference between Bush-era crusading neoconservatism and a kind of purely hard-edged Jacksonian politics. I think that there is a sort of the Eisenhower, Nixon, and to some degree Reagan tradition of realist internationalism is still available to conservatism, and there are people in the administration who would like to implement it. Trump will sort of play with that tradition one week and move on to to a different, you know, he's again many things depending on the day of the week. But that's what I'd like to see in foreign policy. In economic policy, I'm a little bit uncertain because I think everything right now is shadowed by artificial intelligence and its profoundly uncertain effects. I think that there's a real dilemma where, you know, my bias has always been that the right needs a stronger politics of solidarity, more focus on financial support for families, less focus on reducing the top marginal tax rate and so on. At the same time, in a aging, slower growth society, you also need a focus on dynamism. You need some of that libertarian energy. How you balance those things is hard, but I would also sort of, I'd almost defer the question 5 years in a way, because I literally don't know what the AI revolution is going to do to the economic landscape. I think both the left and the right, like what kind of policies you would want are downstream of that right now.
Mm-hmm. So this is maybe an odd question, but I want to ask you why you aren't a liberal, because I look around at a lot of the things that you are worried about. And I mean, I mean this in the classical liberal sense, not in the left wing American liberal sense, because I look at a lot of the problems of the last decade. And I just feel like I've just been shoved even further towards believing that the basic liberal principles like have to be protected, because clearly if one group gets in charge and decides that, you know, it's time to cement permanent victory, they're going to just shove down like their version of the common good down your throat. Like on the right, everyone is, you know, very, very upset about what they see as the excesses of the woke era and progressivism, being forced to talk about things in ways that they didn't feel comfortable about, whether that was through, threats to their livelihood or social media mobbing or just what was considered reasonable or okay to talk about. And then now on the left, I mean, there's a clear frustration with, you know, what seems now as like woke right behavior, which is like now it's the left which is being speech policed and not being able to talk about things they want to talk about, not being able to envision their version of the good in their own communities. And I think that like this has really pushed me even further in the direction of believing that, you know, you don't want a government or a political movement that is trying to tell you how what the good is and how you should live your life in a moralistic fashion. Like I am also a Christian, like I go to church, and I'm, you know, I think it would be better if more people were Christians, because I think it's true, but I don't really think it's good for it's not a good situation if I think the government is taking on that role. So why hasn't the last, you know, decade or two updated you towards liberalism more?
I mean, well, first of all, I would say that I don't have some personal post-liberal schematic. Like I just mm-hmm. gave you a sort of rough cultural and policy agenda. Mm-hmm. I think that agenda is in some ways post-liberal, but it doesn't add up to a kind of radically different foundation for Western society than the set of liberal institutions that we have now. And in that sense, like I basically believe that my politics can work within the structures of liberalism. I don't think the mm-hmm. structures of liberalism need to necessarily be dismantled to make my particularly eccentric vision of politics work. And this is where I'm, you know, in some kind of disagreement, I guess, with like what you might call the stronger post-liberalism of, say, a Patrick Deneen or an Adrian Vermeule. Although even there, I think there's some ambiguity in like what, you know, what someone like Deneen thinks you actually have to do. Like, you know, do you want to get rid of the Constitution? And, you know, Deneen is not actually advocating for, you know, a inquisitorial theocracy exactly in his writings. He's advocating for a kind of philosophical shift in how we conceptualize our relationship to each other, which is, you know, itself.
There's a lot of slippage.
There's a lot of slippage. But let me make this argument, basically. I don't think that you can essentially impose a vision of the good on a democratic society by political force when 35% of the country agrees with you. I absolutely don't think that is an effective model. I don't agree with the people who are post-liberal, whether they're on the left or the right, who have a model of kind of like elite leadership, where it's like, well, if you just have the right elites, the public will follow. And maybe those elites need to be anti-racist and use the correct pronouns. And or maybe the elites need to be, you know, sort of neo-traditionalists in religion or something and tweet about, you know, tweet celebrations of Our Lady of Guadalupe. But either way, with the right elite dominance, the public follows. I don't agree with that. I do think that liberal systems do not function well absent some kind of shared cultural and ultimately religious foundation that helps people argue about the good, and that provides, if not certain answers, at least a common vocabulary. And this is in certain ways, a very conventional conservative perspective. You can find people making versions of this argument going back many decades. But to me, that's what we see playing out in our society now, that the American Republic had a sort of small L liberal structure and then a kind of soft Protestant consensus for much of its history that gave way to this kind of ecumenical Judeo-Christian consensus for a while in the middle of the 20th century. And then as mainline Protestantism declined, that consensus fractured. And we've had different groups from the religious right to the woke left trying to sort of reconstitute a sort of moral and metaphysical center for the country. They've all been unsuccessful, but liberalism can't just go on its own without that to some degree. Mm-hmm. And when it does go on its own like that, it sort of devolves into a kind of hyper-individualist libertarianism. So I think the age we're in now of these kind of competing ideological formations was preceded by an era of kind of libertarian triumph across a range of dimensions where everybody, you know, everybody just became much more socially liberal. And this was the era that, you know, yielded the current landscape of, you know, individualist drug policy and, you know, gambling and all of it mediated by technology. It wasn't just sort of chosen, right? It was mediated by the internet and the smartphone and so on. And I think that makes people miserable. And it sends them in search of thicker concepts of meaning. Now, I don't have a political path out of this problem. Like my view is that I'm a Christian. I think Christianity is true. I don't want to establish Christianity by political force, but I think it would be a good thing if more Americans were Christian and debated fraught issues in a moral language shaped by Christianity. That I would be in favor of that. I don't have a policy agenda to get you there, but that is what I would like to see. Maybe there is some other common language that is not Christian that could play the same role in American society. I'm open to that possibility, but I don't think we've found it. And I don't think a theory that just emphasizes sort of, you know, the importance of neutral institutions and individual liberties is enough to hold things together.
No, I mean, I think the distinction you're making is actually really valuable and one that people don't make enough, which is that I agree that some sort of like spiritual cultural revival is going to have to happen if people are going to get out of the malaise that they feel, whether it's, you know, what is going to stop me from gambling my entire, you know, savings away? What is going to stop me from not finding a long-term stable relationship with someone that I like and living in hookup culture or not having a partner at all? Like all these things, I think, are things that people want, you know, deeper sources of meaning and institutions to help them find. But I think the thing that I get worried about is how much people are turning on both the left and the right to politics to be the place where that meaning is found. And I think that it people often kind of aren't even clear that they're saying that when they're talking about it. They just don't know where else to turn in their lives when they commit to politics. But the people who treat politics as their source of meaning are like the least happy people on the planet. Like these are the people who are like political hobbyists are just like not happy. And more people like doing this. And I see this in large swaths of American life. Like I don't want Trump or for that matter, Biden being my moral leader. I would like them to have good values and that they are informed by moral leaders in this country. But I don't actually think it's good for like this partisan fights to become moral fights. And I do think that there's like confusion about where that's supposed to come from. And I also simply don't have an answer for how you would revive this in a meaningful way. But I do worry that everyone is turning to policy and politics to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely the case that partisan identity plays a version of the role that religious identity once played for a lot of people, and that's a bad thing. And the, you know, the statistic from a couple of years ago that, you know, it used to be in the 50s that, you know, people didn't care if they were Democrats and their son was marrying a Republican. It was like, all right, no big deal. But if they were Protestants, they didn't want their son marrying a Catholic. And, you know, and that is now flipped. And nobody cares if your children marry outside your religion, but people are really upset if they marry outside your political worldview. I think that's bad, and it's bad for society. I wouldn't go all the way, though, to saying that politics shouldn't contain a certain kind of moralistic and religious energy. I think it's a big problem for religious conservatives, especially, that they are just yoked to the character of Donald Trump, who is not a Christian, doesn't behave like a Christian. You know, we'll sort of joke about this, like, you know, the famous, the line at the Charlie Kirk Memorial, like, Erica, you know, she wants me to forgive my enemies, but I can't, right? Like, that's completely true to Trump's character, but it shapes him, it shapes conservatism, it shapes the people he hires, even when they're Christian, it shapes, I think, how they behave. So there is a place for a kind of, I think, moral modeling from our leaders that we don't get right now. I think liberals wanted this with Joe Biden, that there was this sense of, like, you know, that Joe Biden, church going, loving grandfather and so on. Like, I don't think liberals were wrong to want that. I don't think Biden could actually fit the role, in part because he was historically a total jerk. So the only reason he seemed more grandfatherly was that he is becoming senile. But I don't think the impulse was bad. And I think that there is I think one of the best things about the Obama presidency was certain elements of, like, his sort of public character. And it was part of why he remained popular, why he has good approval ratings now, even with people who definitely didn't vote for him. I think there has to be some room for character and moralism at the highest level. Again, even if you aren't imagining that you can impose it. I also think that, like, the law matters, right? Like, something like gambling, right? Gambling on the scale we have now, it's not just a cultural problem. We change the laws. We change the laws in bad ways. We should change them back. Now, can you do that, like, without winning a majority of the country to your views? Maybe not, right? And this is where I think the activists on left and right, they want to skip over that step. But I don't think people, like, are wrong gambling, gambling is the kind of issue where maybe you could just go back with it.
I mean, there's material problems there with gambling. Like, this is my kind of, like, part of my point is just, like, a lot of the things that people want politics to fix, often, like, there's, like, a material problem here, and, like, there's a policy technocratic response to it. Like, people are worse off. We, like, have now, like, significant evidence that they're not happy about having gambled away their money, and you don't even need to make I think it's good for people to make moral arguments.
But then you've stepped outside at least one version of the liberal frame. If you say that, like, well, we can tell they're not happy, and so we want to regulate it. There is a form of liberalism that would not make that step, right? So you're in a more moralistic frame of liberalism.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing
certainly the one that prevailed in some precincts.
I don't know. I mean, like, again, like, this shift in gambling, both law, happened after what we would call the heyday of liberalism. Through the heyday of liberalism, you couldn't just gamble anywhere. Like no one is, like, a perfect embodiment of any, like, ideology that they have. And so there's contradictions that everyone, like, kind of holds and takes from other places. But just, I mean, I just think that, like, you look at the gambling question, and, like, you can say, like, people are free to gamble, but we're not going to allow, like, you know, on your phone,
we're going to restrict
advertising, or you have to go to a certain place, or there are limits, or you can't have, betting markets that are obviously so unbelievably biased against individuals that it's impossible. There are ways to do this. You can even have, like, institutions that are not the government do, like, sports arenas. Like, I think it's obviously worse for sports that this is all happening. So,
This is a very technocratic way of talking about it, which is fine. I'm happy to sit down and devise sort of technocratic solutions to gambling addiction. But you mentioned, well, gambling was restricted through the heyday of liberalism, right? Meaning what? New Deal and Great Society eras. But the big reason it was restricted in that era was that the country was just way more Protestant. Like, Protestants didn't like gambling. It was a sin. And that was the foundation for whatever set of technocratic regulations you want to have, right? And, like, I wouldn't ban gambling completely either. I think you want, you know, there's a lot to be said for systems where you have legal gambling. Like, when I was a kid, you have legal gambling in a few cities, and you have to, like, make an effort to go there, and they are dens of vice and iniquity, and people choose to live there if they want to, but it's like it's contained, and you know, the restrictions aren't trying to restrict it to zero. They're just trying to make it harder to gamble. So I'm happy to sit around and design that kind of system, but I do think that some of that, the capacity to have moralistic regulation, however technocratic you make it, does rest to some degree on like, what are your shared values? And Americans used to have a shared set of values that were hostile to gambling, and now they just don't. Because we admitted too many Catholic immigrants, and they loved bingo at the Knights of Columbus Hall, and that was it.
We're going to have Baptist, to bring back anti-Catholic discrimination to get rid of this problem. I mean,
this is the hard truth.
So I want to switch gears a bit, because there's one thing you wrote recently that's been sticking in my brain for a while, which is about the crisis of liberalism. And you wrote, quote, "We have entered a world in which having a system that generates more growth than the available alternatives does not adequately address the challenges that are throwing that system into crisis. And you have to understand the crisis of liberalism and the rise of post-liberalism in terms of the problems that economic growth alone does not resolve." And in this essay, you kind of point to a bunch of different areas where you think economic growth really can't answer the questions people are asking. So great power conflict, what you call the social costs of liberal individualism, the difficulties of managing a diverse aging population. And I think that you're actually broadly wrong about this, and I wanted to run my argument past you. So first, at a very like narrow level, right? Like, most of the problems that people actually engage with politically are quite material, right? They, even in the 2024 election, where the discourse kind of got super post-material at times, like, really, people are voting about inflation. And I think that if inflation had been like, you know, if there's 2% less inflation, like, I'm pretty sure that Biden or Kamala Harris are president right now. And like, that changes the entire trajectory of what we think about what the Trump moment really was and what the future of the right would look like. But secondly, I think more broadly, my work in the housing anti-growth space, which is now called kind of like the abundance after the Ezra Klein, Derek Thompson book, has revealed to me just how much like zero-sum attitudes about the world are driven by experiences with low growth. So communities that do have enough housing, enough good jobs, economic optimism, are just much less likely to succumb to these zero-sum narratives. And you know, I had an interview recently with an economist who actually worked with a team to really quantify this. But you see that, you know, you see this in like kind of anecdotal historical sweeps. Like, I don't think it's an accident that the bombastic growth of the post-World War II era is accompanied by some of the greatest rights expansions America or the world has ever seen. Like, it's in that moment that you get rights for racial minorities and for women and for gender minorities expanding, not just here, but around the world. I think it's largely as a result of like people feeling like there's enough to go around, growth is possible, my life is eons better every year, I'm witnessing like labor-saving technology entering my home, there's always opportunities available for my children. And so to me, the failure of liberalism is largely an insufficient amount of attention paid to broad economic questions of growth and prosperity, and that many of the conflicts that we see as being rooted in liberalism are actually just like problems of the human condition that are exacerbated when you live in a zero-sum economic environment. So why am I wrong?
Well, you're not wrong that economic growth is really important. And this is why, this is something that, yeah, I think sort of the certain kinds of right-wing post-liberalism and the degrowth left both get wrong, that maybe it's possible to build a stable and happy society in a kind of steady state form where you don't have an expanding pie. But in, you know, the 21st century global landscape, you're not getting there from here. You need growth. Growth is good. A politics that increases growth will win over a politics that kills growth. And yeah, that's sort of a baseline, right? And it's what, you know, it's to the extent that I'm sort of always like thinking through the balance between libertarianism and communitarianism in conservative politics, it's what makes me always give credit to the libertarians, even though I'm not one, right? That like they are doing something really important in prioritizing growth. As to the current situation in the world, though, I just think there's a lot of problems growth doesn't solve. Yes, growth maybe gets Kamala Harris an extra 2.5% of the vote. And, you know, and if you're sort of organizing your politics around like winning one election cycle or something, then of course, you know, you want to think a lot about what the politics of growth are. But like, you know, if you look across the Western world right now, you have very rich societies that have a fundamental sort of economic problem driven by the fact that they aren't reproducing themselves. And that's a growth problem in the end, right? It's like, you know, you have population decline leading to no growth, but it's not a problem that growth fixes. Like there isn't evident, like the crisis of population decline and collapsing fertility and everything else came about in the richest society in human history. And
we just need to get richer, Ross.
Well, we do need to get richer. We do need to get richer, but there isn't like the, you know, the first big, you know, anyway, I don't want to belabor the point. I'm just saying, like, and this is happening, you know, the question of demographic decline. Again, I'm not arguing that it's something that post-liberalism has some fix for. I'm just arguing it's one of the essential crises of our time, and I don't think it's solved by you know, housing reform or something like that. Like you can go across it, and again, I'm in favor of much of that agenda, but I think there is some interface between culture, technology, gender roles, religion, the iPhone above all, maybe soon AI, that I don't know what the solution is, but it is not simply a problem of economic growth. So that's like sort of a big aspect of the landscape here. But then there's other things, right? Like I mentioned in the passage you quoted, right? Like if you're in a world of renewed great power competition, then there are actual trade-offs between the generally shared benefits of free trade and their effects in terms of, you know, the United States' relative power versus the power of China and Russia. Like those are actual trade-offs. You can't just say policy X maximizes growth and therefore it's obviously the best one if that growth leads China leapfrogging its neighbors, conquering Taiwan, getting to super duper AI first and subjugating all of East Asia, if not the world. I'm exaggerating for effect, right? But like there are certain areas in global political economy where prioritizing growth assumes a kind of shared liberal framework already. If you have a shared liberal framework, great, you just go for it with growth. If you have this kind of intense civilizational competition, and maybe it will ebb a little bit, there are situations where maybe you have to deprioritize growth in certain ways. Then there's just sort of the question of like general unhappiness. And I agree that like this can be overstated and, you know, there's sort of a million ways to cut the data and so on. But like I've lived through, I'm a child of the 1990s, glorious days, right? at the end of history. A
lot of economic growth.
I've lived through the last 25 years, and I've lived through periods of greater growth and lesser growth and financial crisis and improvement and so on. And I think there's just been a general, you know, a general increase in unhappiness and disappointment and social dislocation that is connected to economic issues. I'm not saying it's not, but is more profoundly shaped by shifts having to do with technology, culture, religion, sex, marriage, family, all of these things. And it might be like, look, you know, I mentioned AI is the shadow over everything. If you go to 7% economic growth, like, there probably is some level of economic growth where, you know, I'm not going to tell you money can't buy happiness or can't buy you self-reported happiness, right?
Yeah.
Like, you want, you know, people, you want to get back to the right track numbers we had in the late 1990s, the number of Americans who say people are on the right track. At 10% annual GDP growth, maybe you get there even if everybody is addicted to their smartphone, high all the time, unmarried, and, you know, just hanging out, right? Maybe you do. But if your political debate is about, like, do we get 2% growth or do we get 3% growth, I prefer 3% growth, but I don't think it's going to fix the kind of social, cultural problem that is not the only reason why we talk about a crisis of liberalism, but it's one of the reasons, mm-hmm. and that needs some other fix. So that's my pitch.
So as you've mentioned in this episode already, you are not a post-liberal, and you have in your podcast and in your writings many sharp critiques.
I'm not a liberal either. I'm very evasive. I don't agree with the philosophical presuppositions of the major liberal schools. So I can't call myself a liberal.
I categorize you as an anti-liberal. Like, you're not post-liberal.
I am content to live under a liberal system if there is not a better alternative.
So I want to ask you this because, you know, one thing that you wrote about, we at The Argument are really interested in this question of where the post-liberal right comes from and what's driving it, and it's what we see as many contradictions. And you wrote that you would bet on post-liberalism as a passing force, a purely temporary reaction. Why don't you think it has more staying power if you're diagnosing liberalism with many of the ills of whether it's gambling, social disaffection, social dislocation? Like, why does it have more staying power to defect to the post-liberal right?
When did I say this? Oh, wait, here we go. Wait. All right. One of the problems
you write
with
so
writing,
much, Ross. You don't
with
even
writing,
know.
I knew, well, and yeah. No, that's no, no. You are, look, I don't want to. I said if an accurate this actually connects to the mm-hmm. conversation, the exchange we were just having. I was saying if an accurate assessment of wealth and opportunity in the America of 2025 settled all debates, then I would bet on post-liberalism as a passing force, a purely temporary reaction. But the crisis is wider and deeper than that, and the future is more perilous. This is where I get, you know, totally vague and open-ended, as I always do, for liberalism and its champions, for would-be post-liberals, for us all. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying basically
okay,
that
if you
just think that we're having an argument about, like, has the economy been maybe a little better than mm-hmm. its critics think? And it has been a little better, and it can get even a little better than that. And post-liberalism is just sort of a, like, internet-abetted misunderstanding of the economic situation, then it's more likely to be temporary. But to the extent that it's connected to these deeper forces, like the ones I threw out in an attempt to convince you, then mm-hmm. it's likely here for a while. It's not, I guess, where I don't think the post-liberals have solutions. This, again, why I think that they are speaking into and identifying real problems in the liberal moment or the crisis of liberalism, and that sometimes they get some things philosophically correct that I agree with. But in terms of, like, an actual effective politics, they aren't there yet. And to the extent that, like, you know, you see, to the extent that they are able to take power, they end up developing their own kind of tunnel vision, which you see with the Trump administration and immigration, for instance, right? Like, here I would say that sometimes liberal technocrats have tunnel vision about where it's like, well, we just need to build more housing and get growth rates up. But with, you know, post-liberals will diagnose this whole panoply of early 21st century cultural problems, and then they'll take power and they'll be like, all right, we're going to deport the immigrants, and that will fix it.
That will solve everything.
And you see this, like, in the rhetoric of, you know, of sort of post-liberal inflected Republican politicians where, it's like, well, you know, you're upset about this, it's immigration. You're upset about that, it's immigration. And I think that there are ways in which limiting immigration can absolutely fit into a reasonable right of center politics, but there's no capacious post-liberal agenda yet that I've seen in politics anywhere in the West.
You interviewed Yoram Hazony recently, who's an Israeli-American scholar and one of the, I would call him the fathers of the post-liberal movement here in the United States. And one line of your conversation struck me as, like, quite vindicating for liberalism. You're talking about the rise of anti-Semitism on the right. And you point out that many, you know, liberals have argued that, quote, while maybe Jewish nationalism is good for the Jews because it's enabled the establishment of the state of Israel, nationalism writ large is almost always bad for the Jews. And this is not your argument, but you are raising this to Yoram as an argument that people like myself have made, which is that it's self-evident that if you are a minority group and that is like an important part of your identity and you are going to feed into a nationalist politics, that is just going to be bad for you because you're never going to be the one deciding what the common good is. Why is this something that is not self-evident to more minority groups in the post-liberal right coalition? Like, I get if you're like a, you know, maybe a white Christian American, why nationalism could appeal to you. I mean, I think you're wrong for your own self-interest, but I understand how the logic works. It does not make sense to me how minority populations like Jews would ever find value in that kind of ideology in America.
So 2 points. One, part of engaging with politics is just sort of dealing with reality. So I don't think that we have a kind of nationalist moment around the world because a few pundits and think tankers made a kind of like mistake of calculation and were like, mm-hmm. Oh, I think they thought nationalism was good, but actually it's bad. And if they just like made a different calculation, we'd be in a different landscape. I think most of the intellectual debates of the post-liberal era are downstream of larger trends. And it's intellectuals trying to follow them and fasten their ideas onto them and make and shape them, right, and direct them. Mm-hmm. But that's just one point. Like, I think in the landscape of the early 21st century, nationalism in some form was going to make a comeback. And so some kinds of political engagement are just people trying to work in that world. And in that world, if the right is going to be more nationalist, Yoram Hazony wants it to be philo-Semitic rather than anti-Semitic. And he's going to try and make that happen, whether it's the absolute ideal form or not. The other point, though, is that, and this is a little more like, this is less about Jews per se than about maybe minority groups writ large. But like nationalism is a form of assimilation. And I don't think it's surprising, actually, that you have Hispanic, like Latino, sort of non-white American children of fairly recent immigrants who are pulled into kind of nationalist politics. I think that they are sort of essentially trying to embrace and create and forge a sense of American identity that they, as, you know, as people who are not heritage Americans or whatever, you know, whatever term you want to use, like, you know, that
no heritage Americans on this podcast right now, Ross. Just
right. Well, yeah. I mean, I have a lot of ancestors, but you know, there's a way in which nationalism is an assimilative force that people who are not at the center of a nation's history often sort of attach themselves to and embrace. And so there are weird dynamics in our time where there are, you know, some of the waspiest, like New Englandiest people are the resistance libs, right? Mm-hmm. And then they're pitted against a right of center coalition that, you know, seems to have a bunch of non-whites in it, right? And, you know, you could take this to extremes with, you know, the like sort of Andrew Tate Brigade. And it's like, well, even our neo-Nazi, sorry. Are white, right?
Yeah.
And but there is something I think important to understand about nationalism there, that yes, there are forms of nationalism that are just sort of about race and are sort of exclusivist along racial lines. But there are lots of forms of nationalism that are about forging a new identity out of a bunch of peripheral identities. What is, you know, the making of France is a bunch of sort of, you know, small regions and so on, a centralized project of forcing them together. Anyway, I'm wandering afield here, but you take my point, right?
Saying.
That like there's a way in which there are people for whom there are non-white people for whom nationalism is appealing as a binding ideology for a nation that they want to be part of.
you know, the one thing I'll say here is I think that the Hispanic and the Latino minority that voted for Trump in record numbers, I mean, they're fleeing the party now. I mean, you see this is as the immigration raids have become way more intrusive in their lives than they expected. And I think that that's like actually in many ways kind of proving the point of like why minority groups were going to be disadvantaged by nationalist forces if they even if they try to add themselves to that bandwagon. And I think I would distinguish too between like, you know, a patriotism and a liberal and a nationalism, which I agree that there's some form of like, you know, every, you know, the forming of every nation requires nationalism. But, you know, there are ways in which I think that the left's failure to engage in kind of a pro-America patriotic project made it difficult for that kind of assimilation to happen there. And, you know, on your broader point that you kind of brought up a few times already, like, you're right. We're seeing forces all around the world. It's hard to be super particularist about the United States, like specific choices that people made leading to specific outcomes when you see the rise of anti-immigration politics, the rise of nationalism happening in places all over. But I think this is actually sometimes, I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot because this is a feature of the world that has been around for a while. Like fascism rose around the world, you know, similar place, it's similar times in very different places, very different institutions. Feminism, democracy, now again, nationalism, authoritarianism. And I think that like, it's true that there is something structural going on, but I think we sometimes underrate the way that ideas actually spread and that the choices that individuals are making, particularly elites with a lot of power, can have like pretty significant impacts on the rest of the world because ideas have power. Like people are convinced of new ideas and then they are willing to change their politics to reframe them because they feel like it fits the material questions that they have in that moment. And so I don't think it's exclusive of the idea that these post-liberal leaders are having a big impact to point out that it's happening everywhere.
No, I agree, but I think it is. I think people who do what you're describing successfully, sort of step up to the plate as leaders and sort of redirect things, are still operating within the framework of the times, right? So like think about the rise of fascism in the New Deal era. Mm-hmm. You know, there were plenty of people in the United States of America in the 1930s who were very against fascism, who were sort of, you know, hardcore small government, you know, Yankee libertarian types, right? Which is a politics that's pretty far from fascism in many ways. That kind of politics, though, just wasn't very relevant to the world of the 1930s. You weren't going to go over to Europe and say, hey, you know, Hitler, have you read, you got to read some, you know, some Adam Smith and
someone should have done it. Come on.
You know, and well yeah. I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, but like in the end the alternative to fascism, the successful alternatives were themselves quite statist, nationalist in certain ways. Like Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a at times quite dictatorial president, right? And he succeeded because he was working with the material of the moment. And I think that is what liberal politicians who are opposed to nationalism need now. They need a politics that is, you know, that is adapted to a world in which nationalism is potent. And they haven't quite found it. Biden, people around Biden were trying to find that in some ways. That was part of what Bidenomics was about. I think predictably that like, the weakness of liberalism in this is its inability to find ways to make cultural concessions to the impulses behind nationalism, some of them. But regardless, you need, it's, if you want to oppose the worst expression of the mood of the times, you still need to be working within that zone. And that also applies to the nationalists themselves. Just to go back to sort of where we started, you said, well, you know, now Hispanics and Latinos are turning against Trump because predictably his nationalism has, you know, led to ICE overreach and so on. Okay, but that too is a choice, right? Like Donald Trump could have run with exactly the same campaign and message, a immigration policy more like his first term that included, you know, some cruelty, some punitive stuff, but was not as obsessed with maximizing certain kinds of deportation. And I think that I don't think his base would have rebelled against that policy. And I think he would be holding more Hispanic support today. So that's mm-hmm. a choice, right? It's not, Donald Trump was not in prison. Like, he had a lot of immigration options after 2024. He succeeded in closing the border. That was a policy mm-hmm. success that remains popular. And from there, it was like, okay, what do you do next? And it's his own, it's concrete choices, not just the spirit of nationalism that has led his administration to become very unpopular.
Well, on that, I think it's time for our last and final question. Ross, what is an argument that you've come across recently that you disagreed with?
I guess I will choose the arguments that you've heard a lot of, especially in the wake of the Greenland foray or gambit or whatever you want to call it, that, you know, we are living through like the actual collapse of sort of American domination on the global stage. Mm-hmm. I think that we're living through an age of transition away from a particular model of American power. I think if Donald Trump were to be president for the next 25 years, which, you know, maybe with anti-aging technology and dictatorship is possible, but most likely is not, then yes, his style could sort of succeed in demolishing fully America's position in the world. But I think the United States has just a sort of sustained set of inherent advantages in the current moment that will keep allies attached to us and bring allies back to us in many possible circumstances. And so, yeah, there's a certain kind of premature declaration of the end of American power, I think, that I've seen a lot of that I differ with.
I think I agree with you there, which is a great place to end on a show called The Argument.
We're both wrong. We're guaranteed to be both wrong.
But, exactly.
Yep.
Well, Ross, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And, you know, we'll see each other in the Indo-Chinese, you know, hegemony of 2065.
We'll be translating everything to Chinese and Mandarin. That's
AI,
what we'll be doing.
AI will do
exactly.
that. Jerusalem. Yeah. I'm sorry. Babelfish.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
All right.
It was fun.
Of course. Have a good one.
The Argument's production team includes Ranjini Chakraborty, Isabella Pereira, Angela Tracy, Kate Crawford, and Eli Richman. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to hear more from The Argument, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com.